Data breaches have become an annoyingly normal part of life. In fact, there are so many of them now that most don't even make the news anymore. And the problem is getting worse. Last year, there were 3,205 reported data compromises, according to the Identity Theft Resource Center, a 78% increase from 2022. Stolen passwords can be changed. Compromised credit card accounts can be canceled. But when the hackers get your medical data, well, that's a much more serious problem. I'm Herb Weisbaum, the Consumer Man, a contributing editor at checkbook.org.
Welcome to Consumerpedia at checkbook.org. We're the nonprofit that helps consumers select services, avoid trouble, and save money. Because we don't accept any advertising or take money from any business we recommend, you can rely on checkbook.org to be completely independent and objective. Now, here's the host of Consumerpedia, America's consumer expert, the Consumer Man, Herb Weisbaum.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services tracks medical data breaches. Last year, it reported 725 major hacks, the most ever, with records of 133 million people exposed. That's about one in three Americans. In this episode, we'll look at how hackers are getting their hands on this highly sensitive personal information, what they're able to do with it, and what you can do to protect yourself. We have two great guests joining us today. Both are from the Identity Theft Resource Center based in San Diego. The ITRC is a wonderful nonprofit that helps people who've fallen victim to identity thieves. Eva Velasquez is the ITRC's president and CEO.
Hi, Herb. Pleasure to be here.
And James Lee, the ITRC's chief operating officer. James has an extensive background in technology and data protection.
Hey, Herb. It's always great to talk to you.
So, Eva, let's make sure we understand what criminals are doing here. They're getting their hands on your medical records, often by breaking into hospital databases and then selling or using that stolen information. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's the gist of it.
And what are they using that for?
The interesting thing about medical breaches and medical data is they're using your credentials. That's the most appealing part of those medical records. It's not necessarily the diagnosis and all the other things that feel deeply personal. It's things like your financial information, your social security number, your medical record number, your insurance numbers. And they can use most of that information, not your medical record number, your insurance number, but all the rest of it can be used to commit other types of identity fraud, not just medical, financial, to apply for government benefits. There's just a host of different things that they can use it for.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But first, I want to ask you, your 2023 annual data breach report shows that healthcare leads all other industries for reported data compromises in each of the past 5 years. Why is that? Why are hackers drawn to this data?
Well, I'll let James jump into the details on the data breach report, but I can tell you, man, hospital records, it's just a treasure trove. It's a very rich data set, and there's a lot of information that they can use in a variety of ways.
It's because it's easy. Medical facilities have less security, and it's a vast supply chain. One of the things that we highlighted this year is this explosive growth. And not just attacks against a single company, but attacks against companies that have the information of multiple companies. So the vendors and the vendors' vendors and their contractors and just a vast number of people all tied to a single organization with a lot of data for each of them. And that is what you see in the healthcare industry. There are people who process the billing. There are people who process the payments. There's the actual providers, your doctor, your dentist, your chiropractor. There's the facilities that they use. All of those have different pieces of information, but they all have access to the entire suite of information about you and others. So it's possible for you to attack a single organization and to get the records of thousands of other companies and all of the information that those thousands of companies have. And that's what we're seeing in the healthcare industry, is that access to as much data as they can get. It's entirely possible that if you haven't been impacted by a healthcare breach, you're going to be in the future.
So with financial identity theft, the bad guys use my information to open new bank accounts or apply for loans or steal my social security payments. What do medical identity thieves do with the information? How do they monetize it?
They are doing much of those same things, but they can also do more. we tend to think in silos. We think, okay, my information was breached at a hospital. Therefore, the thieves are only going to use it to commit medical identity theft. Well, actually, that's false because that data can be used in all different sectors. So they are doing just what you listed, opening new bank accounts, applying for loans. They could steal your social security payments, but they can also do other things like get medical goods or services in your name, durable medical equipment. They can even get prescriptions in your name. There are so many different ways that they can monetize it. And also when you think about the fraud ecosystem, the same entity or organized ring that accessed the data, that exploited the vulnerability within the hospital system to get their hands on the data, they may not be the ones using it. They're going to put it out for sale. And they're not going to just sell it to one person. They'll sell it to anybody who buys it. So you have many, many different types of criminals purchasing that data to do many different things with it.
Which leads me to, how lucrative is this crime? What's the going rate for stolen medical files as opposed to, say, stolen credit card numbers?
There's an annual report that comes out in April every year that looks at what is the sort of the going rate for information. One of the most interesting things is you don't go to your identity marketplace and say, I want a medical file. Information about the state of your health has no value. It has no value in an identity marketplace. They're after those constituent parts of that file. So a credit card, depending upon what kind of credit card it is, may go from between $30 to $60. But if you have a stolen prescription label, that can go for as much as $100, or that just the information from the prescription label can go for $100. There's other kinds of information that if they have access to, it's going to go from anywhere from $10 or $15 all the way up to hundreds of dollars. So on a per piece of information basis, it's quite lucrative because there is this insatiable thirst for information that the identity criminals have that they're going to turn around and use to commit another kind of crime.
So what do they do if they use this information to buy drugs in my name or buy wheelchairs in my name or medical equipment? Do they then sell that, or what do they do? What are they doing with the stuff they buy?
Yeah, they turn around and they sell it. Herb, you know this. They're very good at making money. They will find a way to make money off of anything they can get their hands on.
So could you guys speak to how they're breaking into these databases? I mean, are they using phishing email, or they have inside sources? Are they using some techno hacking thing, all the above? How are they getting into all these medical databases?
There's two ways. There's exploiting the technical vulnerabilities, and James will speak to that. But we also have to remember, with social engineering and phishing, that's where they're hacking into our brain. They're getting us to click on a link, whether it's an employee or an end user. They're using both tactics.
To Eva's point, when they're breaking into databases, they're either getting into it because they've social engineered their way in. Maybe they talked their way in to getting access. But they also are using information stolen from other data breaches. And one of the main things they use are legitimate credentials, legitimate login and passwords from an organization or from an individual that they can then use to get into a system that has medical information. That's a very common way. You also see a high level of malware, and now they're using some technical means to get in. Because you have so many organizations, and a lot of them are very small, who don't have the same level of cybersecurity that a large multinational healthcare organization would, which is one of the reasons why the bad guys target those smaller organizations in this big supply chain, because they don't have the protections. So we're seeing that here as well, where they're specifically seeking out small groups that just can't stand up to either the kind of malware or the brute force attacks or the social engineering. A bigger organization that has better resources, they can stand up against that, but smaller organizations more often than not cannot do that.
James, when I first started reporting on medical identity theft, a lot of the problem was blamed on sloppy security practices, such as people carrying around information on laptops, leaving it in their car, or not encrypting the data. Is this still a problem?
When we talk about back in the day, we're talking about, what, 10 years ago, which it doesn't seem that long ago. You did have issues with information being left out in the open. We still had paper files even 5 and 6 years ago. They're being stolen, or they would be improperly disposed. We still see that. We don't see that the way we do the more sophisticated kind of attacks. Today, the risk is primarily to these electronic records, and that's why you have to have a different kind of security practice. We haven't really fully made the transition for every organization to realize they've got to be just as careful with the electronic information as they have historically been with the paper documents.
Has the push to digitize medical records created a bigger target surface for these ID thieves?
Absolutely. Let's think of it in practical terms. If we were having this conversation 15 years ago, an organization that was processing medical claims would have a room with literally hundreds of filing cabinets, and there would be all manner of paper documents flying here and there. Just physically, it's very difficult for an identity thief to access that, certainly not to access it at scale. Fast forward to today, that information's in a cloud. Anybody who gets the credentials to get into that cloud, or anybody who can introduce malware that allows them to get into that cloud, now has access to every piece of information in that database. So we have made it very easy for thieves to access information. And that's not just medical information, that's information period, which means we've got to have as bulletproof as we can security to protect that information.
It also increases the risk surface because individuals, especially with the portals, a lot of people have access to their medical records through these health portals, and they don't necessarily manage them the way they need to. And that creates an individual risk for people. I can tell you, my medical provider just went through a data migration and they're changing over to a different platform. And the emails that they sent out, I just felt like, man, how many people are, one, either going to go, this is a scam, and not respond and then have to go through the process in a different manner anyway. And two, the scammers keep an eye out for these things. I mean, they're in the know. And if they can insert themselves into that process and start sending people emails about, hey, need to set up your new portal, just enter your old username and password here. And then it's just about credential harvesting, because people will click on that link and enter their old password or their username and password. And if they're not practicing good password hygiene and using that password in other areas, maybe it's the same one they use for their bank. There's just a lot of tentacles when we're talking about digitizing all of these important records and then allowing individuals to have access to them through a portal.
You know, medical identity theft can last a lifetime and have life-threatening consequences. That's straight ahead. I'm Herb Weisbaum, the Consumer Man, and you're listening to Consumerpedia, powered by Checkbook.org.
If you like what you hear, we hope you'll consider being a Consumerpedia supporter by using the link at the bottom of the show notes to make a small contribution each month. This is Consumerpedia.
When an identity thief hijacks your bank account or opens a new credit card in your name, there's usually something you can do to get things right again fairly quickly. And in most cases, the financial institutions will take the loss, not you. Eva, what sort of things happen to victims of medical identity theft?
Well, Herb, I'll tell you, this is a real life story. It can be all of the same implications that you get with financial identity theft, but then it just balloons. There's not something, one universal place where you can go to resolve this issue. We had a woman who was a victim of medical identity theft, had her identity misused to get medical services, but also prescriptions. So she was dealing with mixed medical records where she had improper diagnoses within her medical records that she had to clean up. She was dealing with her insurance provider trying to prove to them that I did not receive those, and she had to go through that issue of proving that to them. But with the prescriptions, what ended up happening was, because it was for narcotics, it triggered law enforcement intervention because it was many different pharmacies all in the same region. She not only had to deal with all of the medical issues and was unable to get prescriptions that she needed for her own medical care, but now law enforcement was investigating her for a crime, and she had to deal with that. And she didn't learn about that until they actually came to her home to issue an arrest warrant, went to her children's schools, pulled them out of school, and put them in the custody of Child Protective Services.
Wow.
It was absolutely devastating for her. And she did nothing. She was not a party to any of this. She did absolutely nothing wrong. but all of the burden fell on her to prove that she wasn't engaging in this behavior. Again, to the point where she had to deal with the criminal justice system in addition to her insurance provider and her healthcare provider.
Well, when I first heard this story a long time ago, I talked to a teenager who was trying to donate blood. There was a blood drive at her high school because a bunch of kids had a car accident and they needed blood. And she was told that she couldn't donate blood because she had AIDS. And clearly this little girl did not have AIDS, but it was in her medical record. And after doing a lot of checking, it took them like a month working with the Red Cross to get the documents changed. But somebody obviously had used her medical information to get treatment for AIDS somewhere else in the country. And somehow that got stuck in her medical file. And, you know, that's kind of scary when that kind of thing happens.
That's terrifying when that happens. I mean, what about when it's less obvious and you don't know and your doctor is operating under the wrong set of facts and not diagnosing you for a problem? You know, maybe you have all the hallmarks for appendicitis and you should have your appendix removed, but your medical file says you already did. So your doctor is not going forward in that diagnosis because they go, well, that can't be it. I mean, think about that.
James, can victims of medical identity theft ever rest easy, or do they need to be vigilant for the rest of their lives that false medical information may show up in the files somewhere, sometime?
Unfortunately, the reality is it is going to be a lifetime of diligence. And it's not just for victims of medical identity theft. It's people whose identities are compromised, period, because it is something that we see time and again in our research and in talking to victims. If you have been the victim once, there's a very high likelihood you're going to be a victim again, even within the first 12 months. So it is something that you have to be watchful for at all times.
And the burden of these losses is shouldered by Medicare or Medicaid, the federal government, or ultimately all taxpayers or private insurance companies, which drives up premiums for everyone, right?
We all pay the price for identity crimes.
So is there anything being done to secure our medical records? And are there things you can do to protect yourself? We'll talk about that next. I'm Herb Weisbaum, the Consumer Man, and you're listening to Consumerpedia, powered by Checkbook.org.
Consumerpedia, fast facts. Some well-known companies have had some significant breaches in the past 10 years. At Yahoo, 3 billion accounts were compromised in 2017. In this breach, security questions and answers were also leaked. Yahoo had an earlier breach of 500 million accounts in 2014. LinkedIn had 700 million accounts exposed in 2021. This breach affected more than 90% of all LinkedIn users. Facebook had 533 million user accounts exposed in 2019. And in 2018, Marriott International said hackers had stolen the account information of approximately 500 million Starwood Hotel customers.
So, James, what's being done, if anything, to stop the hackers from getting into these databases and stealing our medical files?
The main thing is large organizations are actually investing a significant amount of money, particularly the publicly traded healthcare companies, to secure this information. And they're giving the people in their food chain, in their supply chain, assistance to also secure their system. So we've got working from there. We do have a whole series of new regulations that have been implemented, particularly for publicly traded companies, that are going to give companies additional incentive because they want to avoid fines and enforcement actions. So we'll see some improvement from that. But at the end of the day, we've got to make sure that we're being equally as diligent and as innovative as the bad guys. The bad guys are really good about, once we make some defensive action, they'll find a way around it. We've got to be equally good as then finding a way around that and trying to get ahead.
Can state or local governments fine medical providers after a hack? And if so, does this ever happen?
They can under their state Medicaid laws. That's the primary venue. And there may be other laws that a particular state has that's unique to their state around just a general data breach. Again, it may not have to be limited to medical purposes. There may be some enforcement action available there. The strongest enforcement, the strongest regulation we have in the U.S. is, people may have heard the term HIPAA, which governs healthcare organizations across the country. And there are some very strong enforcement actions that can be taken by the Department of Health and Human Services, and they take them every year. They investigated more than 600 data breaches last year. They issued fines totaling more than $2.4 million. And they're not only diligent about assessing fines when that's the best thing, more importantly, they're very good at telling people what they have to do to improve. It's one thing to just fine them. It's another thing to help them get better so it doesn't happen again. And under the HIPAA rules, HHS really does take that role of, we're going to help you get better. They take that very seriously. And that's important because you don't always see the repeat attacks and repeat breaches that you do in other sectors once a healthcare organization's been attacked and they've been tagged by HHS. You don't see that re-attack rate the same you do elsewhere. So that's very effective, but there's still a lot more we could do to help prevent these kind of attacks.
Eva, is there anything I can do to secure my medical records? It seems like it's up to those who collect it to secure it.
Well, it's a shared responsibility, but you're right. Your provider has a responsibility to be a good steward of those records and the data that you give them. Now, you can ask them for their policies, their data security and privacy policies. Ask them how they're keeping your information safe. But you can play a role just practicing good identity hygiene. Now, when it comes to medical identity theft, the top two things I tell people to do are read your explanation of benefits. It's such a habit. You see the statement, this is not a bill, on the top, and you go, I don't have to be worried about this because they're not asking me for money. But read it and make sure that you recognize the goods and the services and the appointments that are described. And if you don't, inquire and ask questions. And then also review your medical records and make sure that they're accurate. It's a lot easier to do that now, especially with all the health portals online. You can actually go in and just look at what are the diagnoses, what medications do they have listed for me. It's good for your health anyway, but it's definitely good for your identity health.
So if you get that monthly statement that we all get and we toss it without looking at it because it says this is not a bill, if you look at it and see that you just had a kidney transplant in Cleveland and you live in Seattle and were never in Cleveland and haven't had a kidney transplant, that's a pretty good sign that somebody's playing around with your medical identity, right?
That's a big indicator. I think the one that I found the most interesting was from an elderly woman who called us and said, I just got this explanation of benefits for my vasectomy that was performed in Florida. And, you know, I live in Oklahoma. And she goes, now I know that's not me. Sometimes it's not that obvious. And I think that's the challenge for some consumers is you may see physicians on there that you're going, I don't know who that is, but it could be a lab test. You can usually trace it back to some kind of care that you received. But I still encourage people, if you don't recognize it, start asking questions.
And on your portal, you could look for things like drugs that were never prescribed or procedures mm-hmm. you never had or that sort of thing, right? That would be a giveaway there.
Exactly. Exactly. Anything that you're just going, that just doesn't sound like a service I got or something that I needed, or that's unbeknownst to me that I have that health condition. That's a huge red flag.
I'd like to point out that we're talking about medical breaches as a cause for medical fraud, but this can happen without a big data breach. If you carry all your medical information around within your wallet and you lose your insurance card in the wallet, somebody grabs it, they could cause you some problems as well, right, James?
They sure could. And you also, a lot of people today, they have their health savings account, which comes with a debit card. So you lose that debit card, you could also have fraud committed there as well. The physical card, if you don't need it, don't take it with you. Just use it those times when you know you're going to go to your medical provider. And the rest of the time, don't keep it in your wallet. Now, people who have smartphones, there's any number of apps that you can use to store that information so you can keep that physical card in a very safe location. It is a risk to walk around just the way it's a risk to walk around with your checkbook or risk to walk around with your Social Security card. You wouldn't think about doing those things these days. So you have to treat this kind of information that same level of security.
You know, typically breach victims are offered free credit monitoring for a year or two. Doesn't correct the problem or prevent bad things from happening, but when I get them, I figure it's free, might as well sign up for it. Eva, is that a good way to go?
That is what we encourage people to do. Even if it's multiple providers, it is free. It doesn't create any harm and it can take a little bit of the burden off of you. But I always caution people, if you have a free service or even if you're paying for a service, that doesn't mean that you can abdicate all responsibility. You still need to play an active role in monitoring your identity and being a partner in that with whatever provider you're being offered.
James, do we now live in a world where you have to assume your identity, medical or otherwise, has been part of a data breach and you've got to act accordingly? You've got to check your files and look for signs of fraud and have really strong passwords, et cetera?
We absolutely live in a world where if you're an adult in the United States, you have to assume your information has been compromised. Now, maybe it hasn't been misused yet, but it's available. So you have to take all of those precautions we talk about all the time just because it may happen to you. But you can almost be certain that your information is in the wild, as we say, and is available for somebody to misuse it.
And for someone who's been the victim of identity theft or worries they may be or just wants information on how to protect themselves, you can contact the Identity Theft Resource Center. Eva, talk a little bit about how people reach you and what you can do for them.
Well, you can talk to a real live advisor. You can call us on our toll-free number. You can live chat with us on our website. And what we will do is really help you with where to start, because that's what a lot of people don't know. They have this big problem in front of them and they don't know what steps to take. And it's very important to understand what type of information was compromised, how it's being misused, where it's being misused, if it's being misused. And we take that guesswork out. All of our services are completely free to the public. We are a 501c3 charity, so we never charge consumers and victims for the recovery plans that we provide or the risk minimization plans that we provide. You can reach our advisors at 888-400-5530. And our website is ID, that's India David, Theft, T-H-E-F-T, Center, C-E-N-T-E-R.org.
Eva, I got to tell you, your organization does wonderful work. They help lots of people. So thank you for what you're doing. And thank you, Eva Velasquez, the president and CEO of the Identity Theft Resource Center, and James Lee, the ITRC's chief operating officer, for being with us today. I think you gave us a lot of really great information.
Always good to be here, Herb.
Yeah, thanks, Herb.
Well, that's it for this edition of Consumerpedia. We hope you'll rate this episode and follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Remember, we release new episodes every other Thursday. Another way you can support this show is to follow us on Consumerpedia on Facebook and Instagram, and at MyConsumerpedia on Twitter. I'm Herb Weisbaum. Thanks for listening.
Consumerpedia is a public service of Checkbook.org. We're a unique nonprofit that helps you save money and make smarter choices. You can count on Checkbook to help you find the best services and avoid the worst, with local ratings that are accurate and unbiased. If you live in or around these seven cities and haven't joined Checkbook yet, check us out. Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, Seattle, San Francisco, Minneapolis-St. Paul, and Washington, D.C. To get your free 30-day subscription, go to checkbook.org/consumerpedia. If you like what you've heard, we hope you'll become a supporter by using the link at the bottom of the show notes to make a small contribution each month. Consumerpedia, empowering consumers to save money and make smarter choices.